So we're just walking through the PowerPoint that will be made available to you called What is the Power of Place? And this is based off of Dr. John Wuhan's book, Power, Place, State, and Society. And he describes the development of South Korea based off of history and culture. So the first slide you have is of the Seoul City Hall. And typically, if you were going to present to students or to a whole group, you would not give away the secret of it. You would ask them what they think of the building in the front and the building in the back and get some feedback. I'm not going to waste your time doing that. So in the front, you have the city hall that was built by the Japanese under the Japanese occupation. And you can clearly see that it's older and from that colonial period. And then behind it, you have the new city hall that was built fairly recently in the past 10 years or so. And what's remarkable about it, obviously, is the new design. And the Koreans say that they just wanted it to look beautiful. But you can tell right away that it looks like a wave that's crashing on top of the Japanese city hall. So it's interesting that they did not demolish the Japanese building, and they built another one in its place on top of it. So that's keep that in mind as you go through, because that has a lot to do with the cultures at work. Okay, so then on the next slide, we're going to look at why do we even care to learn about this, right? So the South Korean economic miracle, as it's described in Dr. Han's book, and they went from being a country that needed aid from everyone and demolished in a lot of ways from the war until now they're one of the countries that gives out aid, and they're very proud of that fact. So they were able to do that, and of course you can't dismiss the fact that they did receive aid from many countries, but according to Dr. Han's text, you can't just create a relationship between those two and say that that's the end of the road, because other countries have received international aid and they have not been successful necessarily. And the other main feature is that they were able to have democratic success, become a democracy, and have the development economically at the same time. And that's one of the big features of this text, is that he claims that South Korea is very unique in that. He says in order to understand South Korea, and he claims any country and their development, you have to have an indigenous approach. So he means by that you have to understand the culture and the history of the place that you're studying in order to understand how they were able to develop. You can't just copy and paste an idea from someone else to them. And he said that we have a tendency to explain the problems of third world societies with their lack of characteristics of Western societies. He says that's our fatal flaw. So a little background in order to know what we're talking about here. You have to know what a chaebol is. So a chaebol is a large conglomerate within the South Korean entity, and they are hired and given special treatment by the government to do just about everything. So they will have, there'll be a company, for example, that makes cradles, and they also have real estate for grave sites. They've got you from cradle to grave. Lotte has a amusement park. They also build giant ships, naval ships. They are in charge of credit cards. I mean, they basically do everything, and they're described as an octopus extending its arms. And this is a big part of the culture and how their economy runs and the idea of the relationship between state and society. They have no problem having these large companies having such a strong relationship with the government, whereas in a lot of Western societies that would be considered, like collusion essentially, right, or nepotism, and that is not the case here at all. Stop me if you want to ask anything.
No, that's great.
You're good. Okay, so and more background in order to be able to kind of see the difference. So Dr. Han does a really good job of explaining basic economic models throughout the world, and then he branches off from there. So two major grand theories are basically the classical theory of Rostow's model, where it's kind of the if you dream it, you can achieve it model. So he claims that you start out as a traditional society, and then the middle point where it says take off, that's the key. So he claims that you have to industrialize in order to develop and become part of what would be considered a developed nation. And by the end of it, you are like the West, essentially, high mass consumption society. People have moved up into the service sector. They're not having to do lower level work anymore. But it's, if you've ever seen Gapminder, there's a gapminder.org, you can go check it out. There's videos by Hans Rolling, and he does, anybody can make it to what he calls the healthy, wealthy corner of the chart. And that would be under Rostow's model. But it argues that you need to have a strong economy, you have to allow capitalism to take hold and move through, and eventually you'll get there. And then the other big theory is more in the dependency category, and that's on the left side with Wallerstein's world system theory. So it says that this is not the case, that the world system is basically rigged, right? So it says that developed countries got that way by taking advantage of periphery countries, is what he calls them, and used up their resources, took advantage of them, and continues to do so. And therefore, they can never really get ahead. So the visual for that would be like fancy people eating steak inside a restaurant, and then the lower class people are on the outside looking in, wanting it. But it, in the end, it's like it was actually their steak. Like their cow went in there, and they couldn't enjoy it. And the big issue with Wallerstein's theory is that he doesn't really provide a solution. He just says it's a problem without a solution. So Dr. Hahn, in his text, he argues that all of these grand theories have weaknesses. Ultimately, they're too grand, right? They don't take into account the actual evidence from the place that they're studying. And he says that it creates what he calls a dichotomous relationship between the state and the people. And for the South Korean example, that's not the relationship that he claims that they have. Okay. So there's your big background. An example of how the state and society relationship are very different in South Korea. They had a survey that the government said, if we were to impose a one-year freeze on wages in order to promote economic development, how would you feel, right? And 72.5% said that they would support the government's decision so that the nation could benefit. So you reflect on whether you think that you're the people within your nation would do the same thing. Okay, so the question you have to ask is, Dr. Hahn argues that this is the extra component that's left out of other big theories, is how much spontaneous consent is a state able to get out of its people? And it says that you should be looking for state power that's part of the infrastructure, instead of just assuming because they have despotic state power that that is enough. So that he argues that this is what sets South Korea apart from many other developing countries during the time of development in the late 1900s. He said just because a state has power, it doesn't mean it's the right kind of power, right? He thinks that in order to be successful, you have to create spontaneous consent, where the people don't even have to think about it. They are just going to do, they want to do what you say. And then he says there are three factors that allowed for spontaneous consent in South Korea. So the first one is Confucianism, and then later Neo-Confucianism, because it's the mandate of heaven that allows for people to do whatever the state wants them to do. And then Taoism is at work there. Balance of natural elements, and that ties in with geomancy. The two kind of go hand in hand. The idea that you can study the stars and map that out on Earth and figure out what the will of heaven is. So obviously they're all tied to this idea that there is a fate, there is a will of heaven, and your life will be better served if you just do whatever the will wants you to do. And so if the state is able to convey that they are a part, have the mandate of heaven, then of course people are going to do what they want. So how does this come through? It comes through education from a very early age, and that happens throughout every culture, right? But and then through architecture, also through every culture, but this is going to be a key point of this presentation. A general sense of place, so where they choose to put buildings, where they choose to situate themselves, all of this is meant to convey the power of the state without anyone having to say it out loud. Okay, so it says the strength of the state should be found in the acceptance by the ruled of a worldview created by the ruling class. Okay, so this is another, this part sort of diverts from what you might typically learn about Confucianism. in a standard textbook or what have you. So a lot of times students will learn that under Confucianism, the state says jump and everyone just says how high, and that's just the end of the road. And then it's kind of hard to understand because the dynastic cycle will change. It'll just say, oh, well, the ruler loses the mandate of heaven, and then they change to a new dynasty. But this helps to explain how there's such thing as loyal opposition. So under Confucianism, and then for South Korea specifically under Neo-Confucianism, they have provincial schools where everyone is going to learn the texts of Confucius, right? And it says that Confucianism is meant to be a manual by which the entire community is to be judged. So that includes the ruling class. And so these students of provincial schools had a lot of authority to be able to say when someone is not following Confucian principles and not being a good ruler. And so this actually creates an opportunity to dissent against what is considered a corrupt government of some kind. And then this comes into play under Japanese occupation, obviously. The military force and the students of this are going to join forces against Japanese occupation because it goes against Confucian principles. And then later again, it's going to come up in 1987 when they actually revolt against the what's considered a corrupt government and are, have a full-fledged democracy after that point. And then it shows up again in 1997 when the tribals that have been so supported up to this point are seen as going too far with their collusion with the government, and they were able to demand that they become more transparent and accepting. Okay, so Dr. Han in the text it points out very clearly that in order to understand why a country is able to develop, you have to go back to their history. You have to be a bit of a historian. You can't just be a political or economic theorist. So he argues that you have to go back to the Joseon Dynasty, which is 1392 to 1897. And this is when Neo-Confucianism really comes into play. So they were actually not sure who was going to be in charge, right? There were two sides. And so the Neo-Confucianists wanted to have control, and you basically have to pick who you think is going to win the war, essentially, right? So they supported General Yi, who was going against someone named General Choi. And they won control, and so that's why Neo-Confucianism is able to become the name of the game. But Confucianism was already in play before that point, just not as strong. Okay, so to keep that in mind, they've basically just gotten power, and South Korea had a large Buddhist influence before this point. The people in charge before them were really enforcing Buddhism. But geomancy, the idea that you can find a place on Earth, as long as it matches the heavens perfectly and has all of the right features, then that automatically is going to make you more powerful. That was already in place. Taoism was already in place, right? So what they're wanting to do right now is marry those with Neo-Confucianism and to convince people that they deserve the power they've just attained. So in order to do that, they're going to study geomancy and consult with these people for placement of their capital. So you can see on this slide some examples of that. You can, in the left photograph, you've got burial mounds. That's what the large green mounds are. And the mounds are meant to be built up like mountains, which are replicated into the constellations in the heavens. And you can see the mountains in the background. And then if you look in the picture on the right, you can see how the mountains almost kind of hug the community. So if you're wanting to have a home or a community or a cemetery, you want those mountains and a curving around you, and it would make sense, you know, geographically speaking. It's going to protect you from the elements. It's going to protect you from other people. But they believe that it replicates the sky, and the North Star is the pole that you want to be lined up with. And then if you look in the bottom of that painting, there's a river running right down in the front. So you want water running across in front of you. So they are going to publish this and make it really clear. And everyone who is a follower of geomancy and Taoism, when they go to visit the capital, they automatically, we have a sense that this is a powerful place, and so the people in charge must be powerful. And in the picture on the right, they've intentionally put together as many principles as possible. So these gates around the outside are based off of Confucian principles, but then they also have the elements in line and the animals have Taoist meanings and things like that. So they're intentionally marrying all this together. They, instead of forcing their ideas on the people, they're going to blend themselves into whatever the people already believe. Because remember, you want spontaneous consent. And then the Korean flag has... I need the slides to go away. Go away. There it goes. So the flag in the top right, the white background is for cleanliness and purity in the under Confucian principles. And then the trigrams, the lines around the outside, are from the elements from Taoism. So again, you've got, they're intentionally marrying them together. Okay. And to explain the importance of the North Star alignment, he says, he who exercises government by means of his moral force may be compared to the Pole Star, which is the North Star, which keeps its central position while all the other stars do homage to it. So if you can position yourself so that that is lined up above you, then everyone's going to assume that you have power. Okay, so how does that look in Seoul? So Seoul was originally Hanyang under the Joseon Dynasty. So the capital has not changed since then. And so everything is still lined up that way. So if you look at the picture on the right, the palace is in the very center and there's mountains behind it. Okay, and all of this other development. So I put a picture of the merchants and everything on the left-hand side. So they're situated, and you can see the Seoul Tower is circled in gray in both for your reference. So you can kind of see where it is. But all of the merchants are not allowed to intercept and block the palace from the North Star. So they all have to run the opposite direction and be underneath that because they cannot block the palace's interception of the North Star. And that's showing their power. Everything that's governmental is north and south and lined up. And all of the merchants, which were considered lower class at the time, right? They're not producing anything, so they're just buying and selling what's already there. So they had a lower status in society, and political was more important than economic. So they had to situate the other direction and not block the power. Okay, so the Japanese are going to come in and claim that they're having Korea as a protectorate state. So the problem with that is that they forged the emperor's seal on the claim for, you know, we would like you to protect us, but they never asked for protection. They were coerced into signing it, and they forged the emperor's seal on there. So that's not actually real. And when they first come in, they give every authority over to the military. The Confucian principles, the idea of civil service being in charge, they get rid of that completely and have the military in charge. And they also give the merchants, basically, for to use an older term, right, but the economic sector is going to be more important to them. So they're going to add industry, and they're going to reinforce the merchants that have been had a lower status before. And then what's interesting here when you're talking about geomancy and power of place can be found in the top left picture. So they wanted to rock the power of the cultural landscape that the Koreans had before, because that's how you get consent. So it's a little hard to tell from this photograph, but if you look closely, you can tell that the Japanese built their building, and they blocked the north-south alignment of the palace, which you can see behind it, and they intentionally built their building a little bit on a diagonal. So it's almost like the effect of like a ping pong, like they're taking the power of the north-south alignment and they're ricocheting it away from the palace. So that was a huge blow to their cultural landscape. And this is a prime example of why you have to have an indigenous approach, because anybody who's not part of the Korean culture would look at this and they probably wouldn't even notice the tilt. And even if they did, they would say, wow, like they obviously can't build straight, or they wouldn't think anything of it, right? Because they don't understand the background of the history of where it came from. So it's very important that you learn the actual culture and history of whatever you're studying. So the unintended consequence is down here at the bottom, and what it did is that it caused national dissent because it took those Confucian scholars and it teamed them up with the local, the people, and they were able to determine that the state had was no longer serving the people, was no longer following Confucian principles. And so they had the right to overthrow it in that case. Okay. So then this is the last phase. So Seoul, 1945 to present. President Park takes control, and he's going to inherit basically this Goldilocks opportunity, right? Goldilocks would be like the perfect opportunity to tie it all together. The Japanese, even though they would never have wanted to have Japanese occupation, they did industrialize the area and they did bring the economy up to speed as far as the merchant class goes. And so President Park is able to inherit that. But then he's also able to go back to using spontaneous consent to get the people to work. So he emphasized on industry and he says, let's fight and construct. And export is the only way to survive. And he actually went back and, I don't want to say he forgave the Japanese because that's not true, but normalized relations with the Japanese and was willing to trade with them and things like that instead of just completely cutting them off. And he was able to get them to grow that way. And the Japanese became, or the Koreans became, what was like warrior workers is how they called themselves. They were willing to work and do whatever needed to be done. And created these chaebols, and so he would have them build just about anything. They built a highway before they even had cars, and they said, now we've built this highway, what do we do? He said, now we build cars, right? So they did whatever he wanted. But again, the unintended impact is that as this grew and corruption became more and more evident, you again have that opposition, loyal opposition, is able to rise up in 1987, and achieve a democracy at the same time, right? You don't have to give up democracy in order to have economic growth under this model. So here's some examples of what you might not expect to see if you're not used to Confucian principles and those ideas and or learn sort of a surface idea of what it is. You wouldn't expect people to be able to protest because of that. But here you can see prime examples of that. And the most recent one is in the bottom right, led for the impeachment of their president because she was colluding with the chaebols and not doing everything the right way. And they've done it again. So it's a big part of their history. Okay, so on this last slide, you just want to reflect back on the wave and why they would choose to keep one building but have the other one in the exact same place. So the power of that place. But then also to have the image, right? It's showing the power of the new government over the old. And that's a significant part of basically in retaliation to the position of the other building and how that has the unintended consequence, like what you would not expect in your own mind is sort of subconscious of seeing the power of the people in charge. Okay, and then in the bottom right, the last thing is they have been doing a lot of reconstruction of geomantic principles. So this river was around a long time ago, but then it lost its flow and they built over it and it was all paved over. And recently they have fixed it all up and basically brought the river back. And people use it, they go and they play and enjoy it. And they said it was for environmental reasons. But if you look at the mapping of it, they're basically bringing back the water that was making Seoul so auspicious for them in the first place. So once you know the background and the indigenous approach that Dr. Han really emphasizes, it creates a whole new meaning for you when you are looking at the current events now.